It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We head to Capitol Hill with Republican U.S. Representative Mike Gallagher of Wisconsin's 8th Congressional District in the northeastern part of the state. Call in with your questions about federal debt limits, national security, anything else on your mind in national politics. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Congressman Mike Gallagher's district includes Green Bay and the Fox Valley. Representative Gallagher, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
It's great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with the debt limit. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen says the nation could reach its debt limit as early as tomorrow. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy saying he wants budget cuts in exchange for raising the debt ceiling. Where are lawmakers at in reaching a deal in time?
I think what makes sense to me is to pair, if we're going to raise the debt ceiling again, traditionally it's been paired with some sort of fiscal reform. So the question is less, can you get an immediate cut, and more, can you reform the process such that we don't find ourselves in this debt ceiling chicken every year or every 2 years? It's like Lucy and Charlie Brown with the football and nothing ever changes. So to me, what I would prefer to see is pairing a debt ceiling increase with something called the Trust Act. That's a bill I have. It's bipartisan in the Senate. It would basically set up a series of rescue task forces for all the trust funds that are going insolvent. I'd also be in favor of a reform to the process so we do budgeting on a biannual basis. My predecessor, Reid Ribble, led the charge on that. That would just make it so much easier to get budgeting done in a sensible, sober manner. The other thing I'd be in favor of is something called the No Budget, No Pay Act, which basically says if we don't pass budgets on time, if we don't do our basic blocking and tackling of doing 12 separate appropriations bills, we, as members of Congress, don't get paid. And I guarantee you, once the pay dries up, suddenly members of Congress will find a solution to these issues. So I think pairing a debt ceiling increase with sensible and hopefully bipartisan reforms to what is indisputably a very dysfunctional process makes sense to me.
Is letting the federal government default on its debts an option at this point?
Well, that's not the preferred outcome. Obviously, there's a lot of brinksmanship that goes into this. I've been part of, I don't know, at least two government shutdowns during my 6 years in Congress. But I think letting it default would have a bad impact on our credibility globally. It would have a negative economic impact. So that's certainly not an outcome anybody wants to see. But it requires both sides to come to the table in good faith, right? And listen to the American people. You got to look at the last election and try and understand what was the message the American people were sending to us. Well, obviously, we have divided government. We have a narrow majority in the House of Republicans. We have a Democratic-controlled Senate and White House. So neither side's going to get 100% of what they want. It's as if the American people have, you know, forced us to sit in the car, but haven't given either party keys to that vehicle. So I think we need to internalize that and approach these discussions with, you know, not only a sense of what is best for the health of the country over the long term, but a little bit of humility always goes a long way here.
There are reports that Speaker McCarthy is open to cuts in military defense spending to hold the budget to the federal 2022 levels. And, you know, you sitting on the House Armed Services Committee, would you accept defense cuts to get a budget deal done?
I would not. I don't think now is the time to be cutting defense. And quite honestly, any budget resolution that attempts to cut defense is dead on arrival in the House. What I'd be open to is a budget resolution that keeps defense at 858 plus 3% to account for just natural growth and inflation, and then finding a way to discover efficiencies on the non-defense discretionary side. That being said, there's a lot of efficiencies we can find in the Pentagon. I'm open to a process whereby we reduce some of the redundant bureaucracy. In fact, the biggest military service branch right now is not the Army, it's not the Navy, it's DoD civilians. It's grown by over 100,000 people since 9/11. When the reverse has happened to active duty military, it's decreased by over 100,000 people. We have all these, you know, flag officers and general officers sitting in the Pentagon and the E-ring. The joint staff is over 5,000 people. Office of Secretary of Defense, over 5,000 people. That bureaucracy can certainly be reduced. It's just not going to provide you an immediate saving. But I'm open to a process whereby we reduce the bureaucracy and use those efficiencies to invest in hard power that we need to deter a war, particularly a war with China over Taiwan. But now is not the time to be cutting defense indiscriminately across the board.
So let me understand this. So if you go back to fiscal 2022 spending levels and you don't touch the defense budget, then you mentioned non-defense discretionary programs. What types of programs would you consider to be excessive or that have ability to be trimmed?
Well, it's all hypothetical at this point. We're dealing with overall numbers. I haven't seen a proposal, and I'm not on the budget committee, that says we're going to cut X, we're going to cut Y, we're going to cut Z. But we have injected, I mean, as a matter of fact, a ton of money, trillions of dollars into domestic spending via COVID dollars. So I think we need to understand where that was duplicative with existing non-defense spending and where certain programs just simply aren't working. We're struggling right now, for example, to process the amount of money that we've invested in so-called infrastructure. We don't have the workforce necessary to build roads, bridges, things like that. So I'm confident there are efficiencies there, but I can't tell you right now without looking at a specific proposal, okay, we're going to get rid of this, get rid of that, and that's going to result in XYZ savings.
Talking about national debt with Mike Gallagher, 8th District House Representative covering Green Bay and the Fox Valley. You can join in along the way, 800-642-1234. Let's turn to TikTok. Last week, Democratic Governor Tony Evers here in Wisconsin banned the social media app TikTok on most state government devices. And the order left some exceptions, like the UW system, for instance. Does the ban go far enough to ease your concerns?
No, I mean, I have a bill, a bipartisan bill, actually, with a Democrat from Illinois. That's a total ban, not just a government ban. I mean, I'm glad that Governor Evers took this step. The exception for the UW system makes no sense to me. And I think the next step to take is not only to close that loophole, but for the governor to lead by example and close down his campaign TikTok account, which I think would be a positive step forward. The real fundamental issue is this. Given TikTok's ownership structure, TikTok is owned by ByteDance, which is a Chinese company. And at least since 2017, but going back before that, any Chinese company is subject to the whims of the Chinese Communist Party. In many cases, they have CCP cells embedded in their corporate governance structure. The head of ByteDance has promised to make sure that all future product lines follow appropriate political direction from the CCP. So what that means is that the CCP controls what is on the cusp of becoming the most powerful media company in America. That doesn't seem like a good idea to me. And add on to that the fact that these apps are highly addictive. They're increasing anxiety, depression, and suicide among America's youth. I think we either need to go for a total ban or a forced sale to an American company that provides greater transparency around control of the algorithm. And of course, in America, we have a concept of a private company that simply doesn't exist in the same way in China.
But would banning TikTok solve these broader security issues over what you're concerned about, you know, data privacy, data mining, these harmful algorithms that you talk about? What about banning TikTok would solve those types of issues?
Well, I think it would solve the immediate issue of having the Chinese Communist Party control what news Americans see on a day-to-day basis. The best analogy would be it's as if in 1958 we allowed the KGB and Pravda to buy WPR, the Chicago Tribune, Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, New York Times, Washington Post. That probably actually understates the magnitude of the problem. So it would solve that immediate problem, but you're right to suggest that we're still going to have lingering concerns about control of data, privacy, et cetera. So where we need to head after this is to figure out what is the appropriate regulatory structure for cross-border data flows. There's something right now called the ICTS process. It's, you know, it started at the end of the Trump administration. The Biden administration continued it. It's very nascent. It's kind of the Wild West right now when it comes to cross-border data flows. And so could we work with our allies in order to establish a transparent data regulatory framework that allows for innovation and doesn't engender national security concerns? I think we can. And if you listen to a speech that former Prime Minister Shinzo Abe of Japan gave before he was tragically killed, he talked about such a model, something he called data free flow with trust. So if we solve the immediate national security risk posed by TikTok, I think then we need to transition to a discussion about what's the appropriate international and interstate regulatory framework that preserves innovation, and privacy while mitigating national security risks.
One more follow-up here. You have said before that you're going to be meeting with TikTok. What is on your agenda?
Well, I am open to them making the argument that they have various safeguards in place such that, you know, we shouldn't be concerned about, you know, algorithmic manipulation or tracking locations. However, they've said in the past, in recent past, that they weren't, there's no example of them using TikTok's ability to track your location. And then we just had a Forbes article 2 weeks ago that convincingly laid out how they're using that very feature to track journalists' locations, because journalists had sources inside TikTok, you know, providing information for stories that shed a negative light on TikTok. So thus far, they have not been transparent. They've not been candid, but I want to engage them in a debate. And if they have a counter argument that I've not thought of, well, that will improve this whole discussion. But now is the time to confront this head on again, before we allow the Chinese Communist Party to control the largest and most powerful media company in America.
Republican Representative Mike Gallagher, District, the northeastern part of the state, with us on the pressing issues before the 118th Congress as House Republicans get down to business. Call in with your questions, your thoughts for the congressman at any time, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're in conversation with U.S. Republican Representative Mike Gallagher, whose district covers Green Bay and the Fox Valley. He's served on the House Armed Services Committee and on the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. Let's take a call now. JJ in Kakana. JJ, what's on your mind?
Yes. Thank you for taking my call. I just had a comment that I thought it was kind of disingenuous for the Representative Gallagher to say that the American people have given him a car but not the keys. I think if you look at the elections, it's the opposite. What the American people are looking for is compromise. And to be honest, I think the majority of American people are quite tired of the divisiveness between both parties, and we need to work across the aisle and come to some compromise and work together. We do it in our daily lives, in our household, and everywhere else, and we expect the people that we hire to do the job to come to find some resolution. And I can take my comment off the air.
JJ, thank you. Representative Gallagher, how will you work across the aisle?
Well, perhaps I used the wrong metaphor, because certainly that was the intent of what I was trying to communicate. I think I said that neither side is going to get 100% of what they want, so there's going to inevitably be compromise in divided government to get anything done. So I was trying to be ingenuous with that metaphor, but I apologize for not being clear. If you look at my record, particularly on national security issues, I've been able to work across the aisle in order to get stuff done. And for this select committee on China that I'm going to be chairing in this Congress, Speaker McCarthy has given me the direction of ensuring that it is a bipartisan effort. And that's something I intend to fulfill. And I think when it comes to securing our country, when it comes to defending our country from authoritarian or totalitarian aggression, that shouldn't be a Republican only or a Democrat only thing. We just had a discussion about TikTok. I work hard to make sure that the bill I introduced was bipartisan. And so I'm proud that it is. And I want to increase the number of Democrats and Republicans on the issue. Now, that being said, I'm not Pollyannish about the ability to solve every problem in divided government. There are certain things we're just not going to be able to resolve in the next 2 years. But again, I think with a spirit of humility and working hard on behalf of the American people, there's some really important things we can get done over the next 2 years. We don't have time to waste. I don't want to waste the next 2 years.
Let's bring in John in Boaz. John, hi.
Hi. I wanted to ask the senator, how much money are we giving to Ukraine for fighting the war? And I think it's about $150 billion, and American people are concerned about our budget.
John, thank you for that question. Aid to Ukraine, Representative Gallagher.
Well, first, I'm not a senator. I think I'm far too young to be a senator. We've given a lot of aid to Ukraine. The number is less than $150 billion thus far. In terms of total outlays, it's closer to $50 billion. And quite honestly, I understand the concern. That's a lot of money. And in particular, we want some of our European allies who talked tough at the beginning of this crisis to step up. Germany stands out in terms of a country that really hasn't yet fulfilled some of the commitments that they made. So we are appropriately in the leadership position. We're the leader of the free world, and we do this because it's in our own interest. But of course, we want our allies to step up and do more. That being said, we have some allies that have done a lot. Poland, some of the Baltic states have really invested a lot in this fight. Ultimately, I think this is a sound investment for U.S. national security, because not only are we defending a country from authoritarian aggression, not only are we taking one of our biggest geopolitical competitors down several notches in the process, and we're doing it without U.S. boots on the ground in harm's way, but we're also simultaneously dealing a blow to the Chinese Communist Party. Remember, Putin and Xi Jinping signed a no-limits partnership before the invasion. And I think we make the mistake of isolating these two problem sets from each other. And if deterrence were to collapse even further in Ukraine, or if we were to allow Russia to completely take over Ukraine, I think it would give Xi Jinping a massive green light to make a move on Taiwan. And then we would find ourselves in a really, really serious and dangerous situation, the likes of which we haven't seen since World War II. So we have to be judicious with this money. We have to ensure there's appropriate oversight. We can't just keep spending without any transparency into where it's going. But ultimately, I think this is a sound investment in our own security.
Do you feel like your fellow Republicans are on board with furthering commitments to Ukraine?
Some are more skeptical, but I think it's incumbent upon people like me in leadership positions and committees in the House to really tease out the connection between communist China and Putin's Russia, and to explain to people how these countries have been waging a cold war against us for the better part of a decade, and we're just now waking up to that fact. Listen, it would be great if we could kind of do a reverse Nixon goes to China and triangulate the Russians against the Chinese. There's just no realistic prospect for that happening in the near future. And any idea that we could balance Russia against China right now, I think, is a naive fantasy. Though it would be a nifty act of geopolitical ledger domain, it's just not possible at present.
Mike Gallagher with us, 8th District House Representative covering Green Bay and the Fox Valley. Let's go back to the phones now. Margaret in Kakana. Margaret, what's on your mind?
Yes, hi. I was wondering why you guys thought it was fiscally prudent and to strip the IRS of its money when it has been starved for workers for the last 10 years. I personally have had my taxes held up for 2 years because of IRS being understaffed. And every time I call, I have to wait so long, not because they're inefficient, because they are so swamped and understaffed because Congress has defunded them for the last 12 years.
Margaret, thank you. House passed the first piece of legislation. The House passes that IRS bill. Representative.
Well, the concern on our side, and according to CBO, is that you're going to see audit rates rise for all taxpayers, and particularly audit rates would mean about 1.2 million more audits, with over 700,000 of those falling on taxpayers making $75,000 or less. So we don't want to see and a disproportionate economic burden applied to middle-class Americans, lower-class Americans, people that are struggling right now, particularly as we come out of the pandemic. I think a more sensible strategy going forward would be to simplify the tax code such that you don't need to hire an army of IRS agents in order to force that tax code. And that's the real issue going forward. The complexity of the tax code is what is maddening and what allows for the IRS bureaucracy to grow. It's what allows for certain people to, you know, hire their own mini platoons of lawyers in order to avoid IRS agents. That to me is the real issue going forward, but we just don't want to see the IRS go after middle-class Wisconsinites going forward.
And very quickly, we only have a few seconds left. What is the most pressing issue that you're working on in this term of Congress?
It's China. I'm chairing the Select Committee on China, figuring out how we not only deter war in the near term, but position ourselves to win this long-term competition, I think, is the challenge of my generation. And figuring out how to communicate the stakes of this competition in a way that resonates with people in Northeast Wisconsin and not just sort of an obscure think tank discussion is really a challenge I think we got to solve over the next 2 years. This is, as I've said, I believe the early stage of a new Cold War. And right now, it's not apparent to me that we're winning.
Congressman Gallagher, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Mike Gallagher, Republican U.S. Representative for Wisconsin's 8th Congressional District. If you missed any part of the conversation, go to WPR.org/mornings. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about one family's annual food tradition.
Deer hunting is a family tradition for many people in Wisconsin. But what do you do with the venison once you get home? As Brianna Ruppel tells us, her family in northern Wisconsin gets together to cold smoke sausage.
It's a blustery January morning, and four generations of my family have stomped the snow off their boots and reunited in a Marathon County basement to take part in an annual tradition.
Yeah, does anybody want coffee or a Bloody Mary?
Scattered on chairs, tables, even on top of the washing machine, are bowls of raw meat.
They're done with gun season, bow season, and everybody around here has venison.
Of course, these hunters could just take their harvested meat to a processor in town who will have it ready in a couple of hours. So why not skip the work?
It's a reward for a good hunt is what it amounts to, really.
That's my grandpa, Bob Schwartz. The technique they'll use is called cold smoking, a meat preservation method used by many northern cultures around the world for thousands of years.
The expert right here has been doing this for a long time.
That expert? My uncle, Bob Yonke, who continues to pass on the German traditions he learned at his family's smokehouse just 3 miles down the dirt road.
Oh, boy. Gotta be 45 years ago. And been doing it ever since.
Yonke has modernized a few of the mechanisms from the old days, though they still have that rustic Wisconsin ingenuity. Now he's rigged up a grinder to a motor with a gear reduction.
You can see how fine it gets then. It doesn't get all curled up in the blade.
This is Bob's son, Scott Yonke, who was about 10 when he and his brother started learning from their dad. Of course, food traditions are nothing without the secret ingredient.
Everybody says, oh, this tastes good. How do you season it? Oh, we can't tell you. Just eat some more.
Throughout history, different families and butchers could be distinguished by their own unique blend of seasonings. Because the meat is not cooked to 160 degrees, it technically remains raw. Though smoke is both an antimicrobial and antioxidant, it's not enough to safely preserve raw meat.
You have to have some cure in it, otherwise you could get sick.
Now the crew will squeeze the seasoned and cured meat into 2-pound sticks using a stuffer initially intended to run on water pressure that Yonke has converted to run on air. Everyone grabs a stack to haul up the narrow staircase and out back to the smokehouse. In 1995, Yonke built this smokehouse out of cement. His grandchildren's tiny handprints from nearly 30 years ago still there in the floor. Generally, meat is smoked using hardwood.
Apple, cherry, and hickory.
Yonke stacks the wood in a small pit dug into the floor of the smokehouse. He controls the size of the fire by sliding a heavy iron lid to increase or decrease the opening.
This is the adjuster, how you regulate the heat.
The goal is to keep the temperature inside the smokehouse below 80 degrees. Yonke keeps a close watch on his fire, often checking on it 3 times a day. Nature controls the time frame, but Yankee uses weight to tell when the sticks are ready.
And when they lose 20% of their weight, then they're done. And that usually takes a little over a week.
Yankee stands without a visible shiver in winds that blow a rush of white across his land. He looks content in knowing the tradition of cold smoking will be carried on through the hands of generations to come. Surely they, too, will be taught the most secret ingredient of all, patience.
Brianna Ruppel brought us that story on cold smoking sausage. She's a writer who now lives in Michigan. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. And find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We discuss transportation access for Wisconsin seniors with organizations working on this issue in Green Bay and in West Bend, north of Milwaukee. Call in about transportation issues you've encountered in your community or solutions you want to share. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Tina Wietong is Director of Transportation Services for Curative Connections. That's a Green Bay nonprofit providing transportation for the elderly and people with disabilities. Tina, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
Good morning. And Janine Brudvig is here, Executive Director of Interfaith Caregivers of Washington County, helping seniors in the county remain independent. Janine, welcome to you.
Great. Thank you. Good morning, Kate.
Good morning. Janine, let's start with you. Interfaith Caregivers using a volunteer system to provide transportation to seniors and people with disabilities in the county. What are your organization's greatest challenges for drivers and for your clients?
Sure. So, well, our greatest challenge, since we are a volunteer-driven organization and all of our services depend on those volunteers, is really constantly recruiting to make sure that we have enough folks that are ready to serve to help the number of seniors that we're continuing to see that do need that help with transportation.
Can you give us some numbers? How many volunteers do you have? How many rides do you give?
Sure. Actually, you know, we are really, really on the upswing right now, you know, post-COVID and all the obstacles and pivots we needed to do during that time. Right now, we have in our database about 150 volunteer drivers. Some of those serve, you know, just about every day, some maybe once a week, some once a month. It's really flexible. So we've got that base of drivers, and we are upwards of about 200 rides per week right now. And we are continuing to see that increase.
Mm. Tina, acquaint us with Curative Connections and providing transportation for elderly and people with disabilities in the Green Bay area. What are you encountering?
So we provide specialized transportation, which is a door-to-door service to individuals over the age of 60 automatically qualify. Anybody under 60 with a qualifying disability would also qualify for the service. We operate Monday through Friday, 7:30 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. We right now have approximately 55 volunteers registered. However, 13 are inactive due to different circumstances, and we have 7 of them floating off for the winter months of January, February, and March. So realistically, we have about 35 active volunteers.
What is the need like?
We, prior to COVID, we bounced between 85 and 100 volunteers to provide the rides. And even then, we were stretched thin. Because of the shortage with volunteers, we've had to hire paid van drivers to get those with needing the accessible transportation to and from their appointments.
Tina, where are your riders trying to go?
We take them anywhere they want to go within Brown County. They can go get their hair done, grocery store, play cards, ADRC if they want to go for lunch. Dialysis takes up a lot of our schedule. Medical appointments. So basically anything they want to do, as long as we have the opening when they call, we'll provide it.
Janine, at Interfaith Caregivers, without your organization, how would your riders get to the places they need to go?
So, you know, Tina was talking about the places that they take their seniors to. In our case, we need to prioritize medical transportation. So that being said, the greatest obstacle that our seniors and our community run into is getting across county lines. We operate a fleet of 8 wheelchair accessible vans, and we can go out of county with those, which means that we can get our seniors down to places in Milwaukee County and Waukesha County, where a lot of the major medical campuses are. You know, we are taking rides down to the VA consistently, down to St. Luke's, Aurora, Frederick Medical Campus, all of those specialty clinics. That's where the greatest obstacle is for our seniors, is to get to those critical places. So in our case, for our program, those are our priorities.
Tina, can your organization transport people in motorized, you know, wheelchairs? What about accessibility?
We have a fleet of 24 vehicles. 16 of them are wheelchair accessible. The other 8 are smaller transits, medium and large size transit, but they're passenger vehicles. And unfortunately, our funding does limit our transportation to Brown County residents within Brown County. However, we do prioritize similar, with medical being priority. They can call up to 30 days in advance for those rides, nutritional and social up to 1 week. And we also do book routine rides for medical and employment.
So it sounds as if medical care is the overriding request here for where your seniors need to be going, Tina.
Correct.
Janine, you know, what about these medical visits and the ability to get to these appointments? Do you find that there are times when you just can't take riders?
Well, similar to Tina's program, you know, you do have to set parameters. So we ask for about a 10-day notice from our seniors. If we have a 10-day notice, we can pretty much guarantee that we will be able to fill their ride. We have so many wonderful volunteers, again. And I just want to mention, it's really, really all about the connection. These volunteers are giving of their time and their energy and their talents to help out. And what really happens is, you know, you take a senior who's anxious about getting to their appointment, not sure, they're worried, they're concerned, and you match them with a caring volunteer. And it really turns into a really, really wonderful relationship a lot of times.
Mm. Tina, have you seen that relationship thrive? And what are those conversations like in the vehicle, in transport?
The drivers that we have truly, truly enjoy working with the clients. They find it to be the most rewarding volunteer opportunity that they've experienced. And a lot of them will transport the same clients. We have some drivers that will drive Wednesday morning on an accessible vehicle, and he will have the same group of people. So he forms a relationship. He forms a friendship. And not only do they form friendships with the clients or the members that they're serving, they also do so with the other drivers. It's surprising how new drivers coming in will actually know some of the drivers that are already here without even knowing that they volunteered.
Tina Wietung directs transportation services for Green Bay-based Curative Connections. Janine Brudvig leads Interfaith Caregivers of Washington County. Join our conversation by calling with your questions anytime. Non-drivers, share your stories on getting where you need to go. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. With Wisconsin's aging population, we explore issues with transportation access and what to do about gaps in fixed route transportation services for seniors. Call in with your questions, your experiences along the way. Share the transportation hurdles, where you are, and what it's like to be a volunteer driver. 800-642-1234. Janine Brudvig heads up the organization Interfaith Caregivers of Washington County. And Tina Wheatong leads transportation services for Curative Connections. I want to talk a little bit here about budget, because the Evers administration announced late last year, Tina, $5 million in state and federal funds would go toward improving transportation for seniors and people with disabilities this year. How do you anticipate that funding will be used, and what would that enable?
Well, we work with Brown County Planning. They receive the 8521 transportation assistance money for Brown County. And we work with them as far as budget goes.
Mm-hmm.
So it's comparable to what it was last year. The only difference is everything costs more. So with fuel costs, it definitely impacted our budget last year, and we anticipate that it'll do the same this year. We did last year in June have to raise rates from $3 per one-way ride to $4 to help offset those additional costs.
Janine, what about rates where you are? How does that work?
Sure, yeah. Well, since we are, we're a community-based nonprofit, so budget for us is always, of course, a top concern. And we are really funded through a lot of different funding streams. We do our own fundraising, so that's a piece of it. We have wonderful support within our community from local foundations, grant sources, different community businesses, organizations, churches. And then we are also funded through some federal grants that we apply for. Oftentimes those are very competitive grants. So, we feel fortunate to be in a good position. The fact that we have been able to receive some of those dollars. So again, our funding, again, a lot of it is community-based.
So piecing it together through a number of different funding streams, it sounds like. Well, let me ask you this, Janine. I mean, as you see the state government, ending the fiscal year with a historic mm-hmm. budget surplus, should the state use some of the surplus to address transportation needs for seniors and people with disabilities?
I think that would be, of course, a fantastic way to utilize some of those dollars. I think the senior population oftentimes is kind of quietly overlooked, but it is, as everybody knows, it's growing and it's going to continue to grow. And if we don't address some of these issues with transportation, organizations like ours and like Tina's are just going to be stretched to the max. We are already, like I mentioned, we are constantly recruiting our volunteer drivers as we see our client list continue to grow, and we do not anticipate any of that slowing down. So yes, I think more dollars towards transportation, and especially for our elderly and disabled population, would be a wonderful use of the money.
Tina, what's on your mind here? What comes up for you?
I agree. I think it's going to continue to be an issue. There's not enough services that can cover all of the needs, not only in Brown County, but everywhere. There's less and less available. Some are cost prohibitive, making it difficult for them to use. Like the paratransit is a great option, and the fixed route service, however, they're limited with the service area that they have. So getting outside of that service area is imperative. There's too big of a need for just us and some of the other smaller services to fill.
And go a little bit further there on paratransit as a public transportation services service. You know, what is holding it back? You know, is it the time it runs or its route? Why? How does it not provide the adequate need for seniors in your area?
I think just the service area is part of that, and I believe some of the routes have changed due to, again, with everybody having to find drivers to fill those spots that are open, to fill the routes, to, you know, to drive the buses. But they are, that's their funding, and their limitations are strictly 3/4 mile for the paratransit, 3/4 miles within any city bus route is what they serve. Unfortunately, Brown County is a lot bigger than that area that's needing rides. We do, you know, the best we can, but unfortunately there's not services that fill the need and are cost effective for all of the people needing the rides.
Tina Wietung and Janine Brudvig both head up nonprofit organizations working on transportation, providing transportation services to seniors and people with disabilities. Still time to talk about this, 800-642-1234. Janine, when you look at these challenges with cost and drivers and trying to find these funding streams, what does working toward transportation equity mean to you in your county, Washington County?
I think it just means making sure that everybody within the community has access to the transportation that they need to access the resources that they need. In our case, for seniors, it's to maintain access to those services and everything that allows them to remain independent, to remain in their community, to be a part of their community, to be active in their community. Equity just means that the resources are there for folks to get to the places they need to get to.
Well, Janine and Tina, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity.
Janine Brudvig is Executive Director of Interfaith Caregivers of Washington County, and Tina Wietung is Director of Transportation Services for Curative Connections, both working on issues related to senior independence. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.